Hi, my name is Con Koutsikas and this is A Cuppa with a Conversationalist, an entertaining, educational and informative program with a broad array of guests with unique perspectives and experiences. And for more information about my coaching and workshops, visit my website at www.conkoutsikas.com. Welcome to another episode of A Cuppa with a Conversationalist. My name is Con and I am the Conversationalist. And yes, as always, I have my latte in tow. Today, we're going to shower you with optimism. My guest today is Victor Purton, and Victor is the Chief Optimism Officer at the Center for Optimism. The Center for Optimism is 8,000 people in 82 countries and asks people, what makes you optimistic and what makes you feel optimistic? Prior to taking on the optimism mission, Victor was a barrister, 18 years as a member of Victorian State Parliament, Trade Commissioner in North and South America, and senior advisor to the Australian G20 presidency. He's currently a board member of the Yarra Valley Water and Vic Water. The foundation for the formation of the Centre of Optimism was a two-year Australian leadership program, which concluded Australian leadership was pretty good. So why all the negativity in Australia? Welcome, Victor.
Con, a delight to be with you. And given that we're at the Centre for Optimism, my first question to you, Con, what makes you optimistic? What makes you feel optimistic?
What makes me feel optimistic? I have the most amazing children and the most amazing grandchildren. And I cannot understate the optimism that I garnish from my loving partner, Sia, at the moment. So I have absolutely lots and lots to be optimistic about, Victor. Thank you for the question.
Pleasure.
Victor, let me start. So with your infectious smile and your exuberant optimism, people could be mistaken that you're a descendant of generations that have had an absolute charmed life. But nothing really could be further from the truth, could it?
No, that's true. When people ask me what makes me optimistic, I've got a four-page essay. And I say it's really four generations. It's, you know, my great-grandparents lived in Lithuania and Latvia, firstly under Swedish occupation and then Russian occupation. And in particular, they all loved their own culture. So even though they held reasonably high office, they were book smugglers and underground theatre provocateurs. And then for my grandparents, it was tougher still. My grandfather on my father's side was tortured to death by the KGB. My grandmother was sent to the Gulag for 12 years. My other grandparents were refugees. Both my parents were refugees. But I always, whilst my mother's story is gorgeous, it's my grandmother, you know, 12 years, you know, those who've read Solzhenitsyn's The Gulag Archipelago would just imagine what it's like to be in a camp where hundreds of thousands of people died. And yet, you know, she went back to Lithuania. It was a tough life because, of course, once you've been, you know, in a dictatorship and, you know, you've been a political prisoner, you're a bit of a, you know, people don't want to hang out with you. But in the late 80s, she rang me and she said, I want to go to the first rally for freedom. And will you take me? And, you know, there she was in her walking frame. And she said to me, I'm going to outlive communism. And, wow. You know, we're all thinking the Soviet Union is this monolith. And she took part in, funnily enough, I was watching a cooking show on SBS yesterday, The Hairy Bikers, and they were traveling through the Baltic states. And one of the things they referred to was the million hands. You know, a million people joined hands from Tallinn to Vilnius to declare their freedom. And then, of course, in 1991, that grandmother of mine who'd lived such a tough life, her optimism proved to be well-founded. She outlived communism and she outlived the Soviet Union.
Victor, just to put some context for the listeners, I know your grandmother or your grandfather was arrested and tortured and murdered. How does your mother, your grandmother, in an environment like that, where would she get her optimism from, knowing her husband is locked up, high probability she's never going to see him again, and she's got young children?
That's a hard one. I think, you know, for people who want to read on this front, I think Viktor Frankl's, you know, the German psychotherapist, Man's Search for Meaning. And he gave a speech later on that he added as an addendum to the book called Tragic Optimism. And it's that notion that whatever position you're in, whether you're in, as he was, a concentration camp, or like you and me living in the paradise of Melbourne, it's this notion of doing your best. And so for her, it was, you know, getting through it for her daughter, you know, getting through it for other people. And she was tough. My mother, you know, lived to 92, but, you know, she was a refugee at the age of 12. She could have been killed several times in the next several years. First, she lived under the Soviets. Then she lived under the Nazis. But she always told her stories with a bit of laughter.
Yeah.
So, you know, like she was trapped in the Soviet zone, and, you know, if she had been captured, she would have died. And sweet-talking the American soldiers, you know, to let her cross the border, and, you know, they flag down a car and drive this young woman to Bavaria, or, you know, she was shot at, and she said, well, the soldier was drunk, you know, and clearly, you know,
not a good shot.
He wasn't a good shot. So always her stories, you know, even, you know, there are people who tell stories in misery, and there are people who tell stories to lift people. And Mum, you know, ended up teaching yoga for almost 52 years until a few months before she died. And so, you know, she was able to uplift thousands and thousands of people during her life. So, again, a good example to me. But optimism, you know, is for the tough times, you know, as Frankl would say, and others. And we often, at the Center for Optimism, we actually say optimism is a state of mind, not the state of the world. And our favorite commentary on optimism actually comes from the oldest remaining book in English by a woman, The Revelations by Mother Julian, who lived through the Black Plague, which, of course, made COVID look like a picnic.
Yeah.
And she wrote, all shall be well, all shall be well, all manner of things shall be well. And had she lived 650 years, and last week was her 650th birthday, she could have written the Harvard Medical School definition of optimism, which is a belief that good things will happen and that things will work out in the end. And Connie, are you a fan of John Lennon?
Oh, mate, John Lennon and the Beatles.
Well, what did John Lennon add to that Mother Julian expression?
I can't answer that. I'd be lying if I said I did.
Well, of course, there's a song, Imagine.
Yes.
But he also said, if it hasn't worked out, it's not the end.
Very good.
You know, some of your listeners, you know, may be Pollyannas, and oftentimes, you know, particularly women, are derided for being a Pollyanna, you know, believing that things are going to work out and stay positive. And I recently wrote an essay, Con, called In Praise of Pollyanna, and I was a bit naughty. I changed my gender pronouns on LinkedIn to Pollyanna Optimist, because Pollyanna, you know, both the book from the early part of the 20th century and the film, the Disney film with Hayley Mills, you know, is this young woman who persists through accident and, you know, terrible, terrible trial and tribulation, but lifts her community. And Con, you know, that's what you do. You know, every one of these podcasts is about lifting a community. So, you know, there's you know, on one end, there's my grandmother, you know, who just went through the most horrible trials and tribulations. And then there's those of us who've grown up in Australia with almost no war, no violence, 30% increase in real incomes in the last 25 years. We've got it really good. And it's our job to help maintain the optimism and spread it to the young so they make a difference. I still remember Jacinda Ardern on climate change. She said, you can drive yourself into paralysis by counting the drips off the glaciers, but I prefer to be an optimist you know, we've got the technology, we've got the means. Let's have an action plan. Let's carry that out, but let's be optimistic. And I think Jacinda Ardern carries on that wisdom.
Mm. Victor, when your parents migrated to Australia, much like many other migrant families, as my parents, when they migrated to Australia in the 50s, lived in boarding houses and worked hard. Your parents worked at the Dunlop tire factory.
Oh, yeah. And in a boarding house in Richmond with the rats and mice running around it. Mum's funniest story is she used to come back from this factory tired out and, you know, with the stench of the rubber and the like. And she said, and the landlady kept saying, and have you had your tea? And Mum thinking, well, yeah, I've had a cup of tea. I prefer coffee. But it took her, I think, weeks to work out the lady wanted to cook dinner for her.
I can relate the stench of that rubber. My where we used to live was only about half a kilometre away from back then, which was Uniroyal or Bridgestone, and we could smell that stench of the rubber at night. And Mum would come home and her clothes. It didn't matter what shift she worked, she had to have a shower. She had to put her clothes in the wash. Unbelievable.
No, our parents really had it tough. Mum talked about, you know, coming through Sydney Harbour, you know, and the beauty of it. And then they were in a refugee camp in Bathurst, freezing to death and almost wanting to go back to Europe, even though Europe was in starvation. But, you know, again, you know, there's so many funny stories, you know, about, you know, being in the shower, you know, and all of a sudden his eyes looking over the top and she ran out screaming, but of course it was a possum looking over the shower. And so that's what I love about yours and my parents. They went through really tough times, you know, and in a time when Australia was a lot poorer and, you know, it wasn't multicultural, you know, they were the first migrants, you know, moving into an Anglo-Celtic society. But they did it with humour and they did it with love and they changed Australia.
Indeed,
I'm grateful to them.
Indeed. A very good mate of mine is as Anglo-Saxon as you can get. And he says if it wasn't for the Greeks and the Italians, they'd still be eating meat with three veg.
Mind you, three veg is probably still good for you.
So, well, it's good for you. There's not a great deal of variety there.
But I saw a statistic the other day that said that the Greeks living in Australia, so the Greek migrants, have the second highest average lifespan on Earth. And it's because they have that Mediterranean diet, but they don't smoke as much. So Greeks back in Greece still smoke a lot. Australian Greeks don't smoke a lot. And so that mix of the Mediterranean diet, which has done such a good thing for Aussies.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Victor, we know that you had a long and distinguished career in politics. What led you into politics? At what point
That background we talked about. Yeah. You know, it was, I'm a liberal, you know, I believe, you know, in that liberal image, and so inspired. The book that I really love is by Hobhouse. It's called Liberalism. It's 1911, and he talks about liberalism as the liberation of living spiritual energy. You know, that word liberation, spiritual energy. And Dick Hamer, you know, who was the premier in Victoria back in the 70s, he was a strong influence on a whole lot of young men and women my age, where, you know, they created new national parks. They had the world's second environment protection agency. And then the other bit that brings it together was Robert Menzies, who in his book Afternoon Light said, we were determined to be progressive, not reactionary, believing in the individual, their rights and their enterprise. So it's no surprise, you know, coming to Australia as refugees from the Soviet Union, you know, my family believed in freedom. And my mother always used to joke about this, having lived under Stalin and having lived under Hitler. She said, the lovely thing about Australia is you could say bloody Menzies. and you wouldn't get locked up for it. You know, not that she said bloody Menzies, but she said just that whole notion that you could say bloody Menzies was a thing. So for us, it was about freedom. For me, it was about what could I do to liberate people who were under dictatorship. And so, you know, I was passionately, you know, believing in human freedom, hating dictatorship. And that's what drew me into politics.
You mentioned this liberalism and certainly getting into politics, freedoms, and you mentioned overseas. Did you feel that becoming a member of parliament in Australia, that you could have an impact globally? Was that your belief?
Yes. And so, you know, obviously, you sometimes you don't achieve everything you want to achieve. And I made a couple of mistakes along the way, you know, and maybe I would have had more influence if I'd got those things right. But that's easy to say when you're 64 rather than when you're 28. And in fact, we actually did some really cutting edge global leading stuff. So, for instance, it might sound dull to some listeners who are not obsessed with regulation, but I was the first chair of the Scrutiny of Acts and Regulations Committee. And we developed this methodology for examining every piece of legislation against human rights, against freedoms, against business efficacy, against efficiency. And it became so admired, for instance, that the Commonwealth took me to South Africa. After apartheid had fallen, and there was a group of us from across the Commonwealth who were there, you know, to help them find better ways, not only of scrutinizing laws, but also writing the laws. And then later the World Bank honored me, you know, took me as an assessment group to Rwanda, not long after the genocide. And secondly, then in the late 90s, I mean, to your younger listeners, they probably can't even contemplate a time when there wasn't the internet.
Yeah.
We created the world's first multimedia agency. We were the first people to have free public access in every library. We broadbanded the institutions. We created VicNet. I had the fifth website for a politician in the world. Teddy Kennedy just beat me. So there was lots and lots of stuff where you had this wonderful canvas. And if you ask people, you know, there's so many wise people. I always think one of the funny things in Australia is people keep talking about the aging crisis or the aged care crisis. And yet we've never had so many wise people, right? So why aren't we making greater use of that wisdom? And I was in a meeting recently and someone started talking about, you know, we've got to have a young person's consultative group and a people with disabilities consultative group and ethnic group. And I said, what about older people? And they just looked at me wide-eyed as if old people could possibly have a view on some matter of public policy. So I think for me, one of the things that I love doing nowadays and just last week, I spoke to an audience of 100 women aged between 65 and 100. And we did the workshop, you know, Your Optimism Superpower. And you walk out of that just, you know, walking on air, you know, with the wisdom and what people share about what makes them optimistic. And, you know, like you, although in their case, it wasn't just grandchildren, it was great-grandchildren.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned about why not old people, and I mentioned before we went started recording, I love to sit and speak to older people and hear their experiences because it creates a completely different perspective and it gives you a view that you would have never, ever considered. And I think it's very, very dismissive of these generations not to include older people in their discussions and or decision-making processes. Victor, an interesting thing, you spoke about your mum doing yoga. somebody sought out, somebody who you would not expect sought out your mother to teach yoga. Tell us about that.
Oh, lots and lots of people like that. I mean, when she started out, you know, it was a Catholic priest and young and girls.
But Australian.
No, the
funniest Australian
story, I think the one you've got in mind is Mum had been teaching for several years and had built a terrific reputation. And so there were two unexpected ones in her yoga teaching. The first one was she got a call from the tax commission.
That's the one.
And Mum thought, oh gosh, have I paid my taxes? Have I paid my tax return? And it turned out to be the tax commissioner. And what he wanted was her to lead his execs and senior people who were very stressed and anxious through yoga to reaching a better standard in their own mental well-being. Of course, this was in the 1970s. So this was very early. The other one that was unusual was the senior Catholic nuns. So Mum was approached by the Assumption Institute, which was for the tertiary training of Catholic sisters and I think some Anglican sisters. And again, you know, she taught there for many years because even though we think that, you know, sisters, you know, these calm influences, you know, with their, in those days, they still had their flying nun.
The flying nun, yeah.
And, but yet, you know, living in a community and teaching in schools, teenagers and the like, there was often a lot of stress. So, so Mum actually moved, originally started out under the influence of a lovely Swiss teacher, Margaret Segersman, who was the first yoga teacher in Melbourne. And then Mum was influenced through Christian yoga, but ultimately became a practitioner of integral yoga. So this notion of Hatha, you know, the postures, Raj yoga, the meditation. And she and I traveled together to Pondicherry and visited the Aurobindo ashram, the Vivekananda ashram, R.K. Hegde, who was the chief minister in Karnataka and one of the formers of the BJP, of course, which Modi is now the head of, took Mum and me to visit Sai Baba, you know, the guru. So Mum's influence, both through Christianity, but also this respect for everything else, has influenced me. So I love spirituality. And my spirituality is met whether I'm in a Catholic cathedral or a synagogue or a Sikh temple or going to the Brahma Kumaris at Mount Abu, you know, the women-led Hindu sect. And in fact, we had, last week, we had the leader of the Brahma Kumaris in Melbourne, and I held a beautiful multicultural event with some of the leaders of meditation and religion and business in Melbourne.
Wow. There's no question that you are a, we'll call it a trendsetter, and certainly before your time in terms of your foresight. And as you
that
mentioned.
A beautiful word, Con.
Thank you. Thank you.
Foresight. I listened to a podcast on that the other day. That is what distinguishes us from the animals.
There you go. And so you obviously saw the tremendous benefit in terms of the way the world was changing. You were, as you mentioned, you were one of the first politicians, or certainly probably the first politician in Australia to have your own website. You were commissioner of data privacy commissioner in the 1990s. You're part of the World Bank online forum. So you were way, way ahead of your time. What did you foresee in terms of how the global, we'll call it, communication was changing? And did you see it where it is now?
People used to laugh at me because I used to say, this is the way you are going to communicate to your constituency. I still remember one of the seafood companies flew me down to Tasmania, and I was talking about this ability of theirs to communicate one-to-one with their customers, whether they're in Australia or Japan or elsewhere. Look, for me, I think it's an insatiable curiosity. One of my board members, John Hagel, was the head of the Deloitte Centre for the Edge. And my book of the last decade was his book, The Power of Pull. But he's written a more recent book called The Journey Beyond Fear. And the first leg of the journey beyond fear is curiosity. And I think you and I share that, Con. Mm. So I just love, you know, when I meet people, I love to ask them, firstly, what's been the best thing in your day? And that almost inevitably leads to a conversation, whether you're standing at a traffic light with them waiting to cross the road or whether you're in a more serious environment. So for me, it's a curiosity about people. It's a curiosity about technology. I'm loving using ChatGPT. I love it. I read this lovely article where this PR lady had said it improved her productivity 80%. And I reckon it does. I had to, this email, someone sent me a rude email this morning, and I'm not used to rude emails on a Monday morning.
Mm.
So I used ChatGPT to help me write a, please send an email back that is nice and yet responds to this rude email. So for me, I just love exploring everything. So, you know, you see, and my press clippings are always, you know, about optimism and freedom. And so I get to see a lot. And then I'm on the board of Yarra Valley Water. So we were listed by the Financial Times this year as the leading utility on climate.
Wow.
So I'm surrounded by people thinking about green hydrogen, waste to energy, multiculturalism, diversity. And then I'm also on the board of Vic Water, you know, which represents all of the water utilities.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the huge honor by being asked to speak at the Intelligent Water Networks. And their philosophy, so it was 180 engineers in the room, their philosophy is tomorrow's technology today. But you're like this, Con. The president is the CEO of One and Water. And during their well-being week, I'd gone and done a workshop on optimism, your superpower, for his workers. And I finished off with laughter yoga. And so at the end, so at the Intelligent Water Networks, he said to me, and Vic, I want you to finish with laughter yoga. So we ended up having 158 engineers laughing their heads off, with two of them looking bemused as to why we were all laughing so loudly. But so I'm really lucky. It's lucky. You make your own luck in this space. If you're curious, you're interested, like you, you know, interviewing new people, sharing the stories with other people, it's glorious. So curiosity is key, whether you're 64 or 4.
Indeed. It's interesting.
Can I tell you my favorite song?
Please.
Comes from Burt Bacharach. And Hal David in the 1973 film Lost Horizon. And it's this lovely scene where the teacher is off and this comedian is asked to take a class in French for these kids living in the Himalayas. And he doesn't speak a word of French. And he says, let me take you a different way. And he sings this song called Answer Me a Question, Right or Wrong. You can answer with a question, right or wrong. Even though the answer may be wrong, your question may be right. Answer with a question. So anyone who wants to look at that, just Google it on YouTube, and it's a lot of fun.
Interesting. You mentioned about laughter. I just want a bit of a plug here for a colleague, and I'm not sure whether you've heard of her, Annie Harvey. Annie Harvey has her program is called The Still Effect, and Annie practices mindfulness. And one of the things that she does is laughter. In her workshops, and there's a famous TED talk that she did probably about 8 years ago now, and she had literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people in hysterical laughter, and it's just one of the greatest YouTube videos that I've seen. So plug to Annie.
So shall you and I do it together at the end of this?
I'm always up for a good laugh, Victor. Always up for a good laugh. Don't worry about that.
So good. I have a friend called Roz Ben Mosher who wrote a book, Laughing at Cancer. And she's just published a new book, and she teaches at La Trobe University, positive psychology, well-being, and laughter. So it's a very serious science. So if every one of your listeners can just laugh a little bit more every day,
they'll feel different and there'll be a different world. Let's go to your retirement from politics. And I read a quote of yours, and one of the reasons was you found politics was negative. Tell me more about that.
It was interesting because we were mentored in the early days. Yeah, you go into question time and really robust, and you shout at each other and the like. And, you know, it's great theatre, but it's also important for democracy. It's one of the differences between, you know, many countries and Australia, in that, you know, our ministers get up and are tested every day of parliament. Mm. And then, but we were also, and then you go out and do a press conference and say that the minister or the shadow minister is a complete ninny. And then you'd go back into the coffee room or the members' bar, and the same person would be there, and you'd both smile at each other and have a cup of coffee. Or if it was late at night, you'd have a drink and share stories of your children and what you're up to, and you'd negotiate. So I entered politics with that sort of mindset. You know, that you, in fact, I saw Jeanine McClain the other day, one of the most left-wing members of the Labor Party, and yet she and I had so many joint successes in policy. Mm. So I was taught, you know, even if they were far left or far right, treat them with respect and try and get on with them. I think as we've moved into this century, it's the 24/7 news. So, yeah, that person's Twitter stream is constantly against you. The media has changed. So journalists, my chairman, Robert Masters, often talks, he was trained as a Canberra Press Gallery guy, but you were a crow on the wire, he said. You would look, you would observe, you would report. But now, you know, everyone wants to be an investigative reporter. You know, they want to bring someone down. And so I think for me, I could see it happening in Australian politics. I think you look at there was never a golden age, right? I mean, if you think, why did we create the parliaments? It was because people used to have trial by combat, you know, and the other side used to die at the end of the argument. So parliament's a long way ahead of where it is. But, you know, I'd much prefer to be positive. And so I just reached a point, it was probably not even the negativity of the other side or even the journalists. You know, it was this sort of negativity within your own party. And, you know, Liberal Party now, I mean, everyone's bemoaning the fact that, you know, they've lost every state. Mm. Across the country. And, oh, gosh, it's the end of history. But, I mean, this has happened every 20 years. I mean, you know, if you go back to 2013 when, you know, Rudd lost the election, you know, it was the end of the Labor Party. You know, and now, of course, they're in power every state bar Tasmania and the federal government. So for me, it was just got a bit much. And so 2006, I walked out all flags flying. I remember there was a bit of a surprise because everyone thought I was a lifelong politician. But it was a good decision. So I spent a few years being just a lawyer practitioner. Mm. And then out of the blue, the Labor Premier, John Brumby, approached me wanting a big personality to be Victoria's Commissioner to the Americas. And that was a splendid time. It taught me so much, Con. I was headquartered in San Francisco. We had an office in New York and Chicago. And my job was to promote foreigners investing in Victoria, to support the foreigners who were investing in Victoria already, and to promote Victorian exports. Mm. And everywhere I went in America, there was this stereotype of us as Aussies of the relentless optimist. The chairman of Caterpillar said to me, "You Aussies remind me of the Americans of 100 years ago. Hmm. Nothing is impossible." I had to go and pitch to the president of Eli Lilly, you know, the very large drug company. The catering manager for Eli Lilly was so excited that an Aussie was coming to meet them. She baked party pies and lamingtons for the presidential suite. I think the first time it was ever done in Indianapolis, or the first time in recorded history it was done in Indianapolis. So for me, you know, getting out of politics in 2006, maybe it was too early, you know, maybe it was too rapid a decision. But in the long run, I think it was the right decision, because as my mum said a week before she died, she said, "You've done lots of interesting things in your life, Victor, but what makes you optimistic, which you can see on the screen above me. She said, asking people that question is the most important thing I think you've ever done.
I just want to go back to that question I've been pondering for the last few moments. I started my podcast basically on the onset of COVID, and there was logic behind it. And somebody said to me, what's the reason you do it? And I thought about it for a moment. And ultimately, I've interviewed a raft of people who have near-death experiences, a whole heap of stuff. And the main reason I do this is if one person gets some hope or benefit, or it somehow has a positive impact on their or their loved one's lives, then my job's done. It doesn't matter how many thousands or hundreds or millions of downloads I get. If I can impact, not me, but my guest, i.e. you, can impact one single person, then it doesn't matter what else happens. Our job's done.
Colin, can I share a story with you? We did several sessions in prison. And the third session, there was this very tall young man in the room. And at the end of the session, you know, normally I do laughter yoga at the end and all the prisoners went off giggling. And this guy looked a bit sour at the end. And he was huge, you know. And he turned out to be a notorious one-punch killer.
Oh.
You know, he'd lost his temper in a pub and killed someone. And he said to me, oh, look, I came because the guy in the cell next to me came to your first two classes. And he now meditates once a day. He keeps a gratitude journal and he reads me one page of your book every day. And he said, if I came to your class, you'd give me a copy of the book. Well, as you can imagine, I straight away handed him a copy of the book. But, you know, when I think that I made such a difference in one prisoner's life, you know, that he adopted meditation, you know, that he adopted gratitude journaling, you know, and read my book one page a day. And the other day at this thing, a women's movement event I spoke at, there was an 88-year-old lady who shared her story afterwards, and shocking domestic violence, paranoid schizophrenic son who tried to kill her. And she said to me, look, I didn't get your handout. You know, I had to look over someone's shoulder. Could I get a copy of your handout? So, of course, I went straight home and printed out the handouts and posted them to her and sent her a copy of my book. But again, it's exactly as you say, Con. If we can make a positive difference in people's lives, and you know that other question I ask, what's been the best thing in your day? To the listeners who are still listening, it is the best intervention we've ever done. So have a think if you're an Aussie or an Irishman or a Frenchman or the like. Typically when we greet people, we say, g'day, how are you? Or in Austrian, wie geht's, you know. And the typical answer is not bad, nicht schlecht. And we never penetrate that. The Scandinavians all think we're nuts. You know, why would you ask a stranger how are they anyway? You know, do you really want to know about the twinge in their knee or the twinge in their hip or their, you know, the fact they've got diarrhea this week? And so if you replace how are you with what's been the best thing in your day, 80% of your conversations will be positive. 50% of people will give you an answer straight away. You know, I had a beautiful cup of coffee. I did an event out in Broadmeadows. One lady said, I drove my autistic son to school today. He was calm. And we were almost all in tears to think that this, for her, was the highlight of her day, that her son was calm. And then 30% of people will need a little bit of a prompter. Oh, I can't think of anything. Or, you know, I do it at 7 o'clock in the morning in the supermarket. So most supermarket people haven't thought of too much positive by 7 in the morning. So you've got to give them a little prompter. And then 20% of people won't. You know, they'll have a trouble. But, you know, there's permission to share it. And so if each of your listeners would try this for the next 2 days, get rid of how are you and just say, hello, g'day. What's been the best thing in your day so far? It will become a lifetime habit and people will chuck it back at you. So I was keynote speaker, Con, at the Australian College of Cardiology Heads of Unit Conference. And, you know, I gave a pre-main course speech. After main course, there were 40 minutes of questions. And I gave them this hint. The next morning, they said, look, can you come back and do a panel in the morning? And even though it wasn't scheduled, I came back and five of the surgeons opened our conversation with what's been the best thing in your day.
Wow.
Now, Con, I don't know if you believe in God or miracles, but it was at the Pullman in Melbourne. And those who know the Pullman, it's on a beautiful park and there's a tram line. And so I caught the tram home. And as I'm on the tram, there's this bloke about my age sitting opposite me, engrossed in his phone. And we're both wearing masks. And I said, I hope there's some good news on your phone. And he looked up at me, looked at my forehead, looked at my nose, looked at my green orange mask. And he said, what's been the best thing in your day? He was one of my prisoners who'd been released.
Wow.
Talk about a small world, you know, for him to be sitting opposite me on the tram and to remember that fundamental habit that I dish out. It was just remarkable.
Wow.
And again, it's that notion of yours, Con. Man. If we can make a difference in one person's life. And if your listeners do that, what's been the best thing in your day? It doesn't matter whether it's the checkout man or woman at the supermarket. And these days, my supermarket people throw the question at me first.
Yeah. Going on to what we've been speaking about, what's the best part of your day or what's the best thing that's happened, I interviewed a lady by the name of Cindy Cohen from Tennessee, the Queen of Joy.
Exactly.
And I said to Cindy, I said, okay, what's your morning ritual? You know, how can we get this joy? She said, Con, the first thing I do when I wake up in the morning, I open my eyes and I say, thank you for waking up, because there's a lot of people that didn't get that privilege.
And do you know who's like that? Are you a horror film lover or do you
some of the old stuff? Yeah.
Stephen King, the horror writer.
Yeah.
Every morning does a 5-minute gratitude meditation. Mm. And as I understand it, rabbis in the Jewish faith have a morning wake-up prayer, which is exactly the same. This notion of wake-up. A really good hint, you know, I talked about the gratitude journal.
Mm.
So the thing I taught the prisoners was just to have a pad or a piece of paper next to your bed. And when you're in your pajamas, when you're in your pajamas or your nightie, just to scribble down 3 good things in the day. And it doesn't need to be saving the world. You know, it can be a lovely cup of coffee. You know, my daughter smiled at me today. And the trick with it is it's more powerful than antidepressants for most people. And the trick is to read it first thing in the morning. So you write it down at night, 3 best things, and then you take that pad as you go and sit on the toilet in the morning and just read it back to yourself. And it's just this powerful permanent reinforcement. And you don't have to be disciplined. I mean, you don't have to do this every day. You know, there'll be times when, you know, your partner and you are feeling a bit amorous and there's no time to write on the gratitude journal, or you've had a few drinks and you just pass out on the pillow. But if you can remember to do it, and the nice thing is, if you've got a slightly pessimistic spouse, it's a really good time to try and lift them. So, honey, I've just written my gratitude journal. What was the best thing in your day? Is a lovely way for couples to share that little bit of extra joy.
Fantastic. After your jaunt as the Commissioner to the Americas, you came back to Australia 2015 and you noticed something. What did you notice?
Negativity. It was having, you know, part of it may have been I may have changed. You know, living in San Francisco, which is ground zero for optimism. You know, they just eat it for breakfast. They you know, fry it for lunch and then they roast it for dinner.
Dinner.
I'd probably change, but and also having spent three, I mean, I was always a salesman. I mean, if you're a politician, you've got to be a salesman. You know, I used to knock, I've knocked on 40,000 doors.
Wow.
Selling myself as the product. So I guess I was always a salesman, and a good salesman is a natural optimist. But yeah, I just, you know, maybe I noticed more the g'day, how are you, and not bad or not too bad, and the whinging and whining about leadership, and, you know, Tony Abbott saying Aussies are doing it hard. And I'm thinking, God, I've been to Guatemala. I've been in Colombia. You know, I was in Monterey where people blew up the casino, you know, where people are scared because they're living in the middle of cartels. You know, I'd been in Mexico City with the instruction, don't catch a taxi, you know, and I thought, these people in Australia have got it so good. Why the negativity? And it really astonished me, Con. You know, because everyone mocks politicians, right? You know, the Chinese have just locked up a comedian for telling some really good jokes about President Xi, but you know, everyone's got those humor, whether you're in the Congo or the, you know, Russia or China or North Korea, everyone's got their subtle little jokes. But here it was an antipathy towards leadership. And you know, Con, you see it in the statistics. Tell me, why is one in five Australians on an antidepressant? In a country that's got it so good, the weather's so good. You know, other drug companies, really good salespeople. But, you know, we are either number two or three in the world on the consumption of antidepressants. You know, why is it that the Melbourne University reported 2 weeks ago on a study of year 11s? Now, you'd be pleased to hear most year 11s are still optimistic about their own lives, but they were so bleak on the future of Australia, and even bleaker on the future of the world. So that's what I noticed, Con, and that was the catalyst for what I'm doing today, you know, why I'm dressed in orange, and, you know, why I ask people every day, what makes you optimistic?
So let's talk about the Centre for Optimism. Briefly, what is it? How do you do it?
We're still evolving. So what are we when we grow up? I'm not sure yet. It started, so 2017, I'd finished the Australian Leadership Project and we concluded that Australian leadership was pretty good. So I was still bewildered about the negativity. But I was lucky enough to be at the Global Integrity Summit. And after 3 days of misery, I changed my speech to the case for optimism. And it electrified the room. And I was lucky enough to have Helen Clark, the former New Zealand Prime Minister and then head of the UNDP. She said, turn that into a book, Victor, and I will endorse it. And I did, and she did. And that started a global speaking tour. And then in 2019, one of the Victorian government ministers asked me to do a project on innovation. And I said, well, look, you don't need to pay me. I just want a speech on optimism and innovation. Well, I didn't realize he was such a pessimist. And he said to me, I won't use the swear words that may have littered the conversation, but essentially it was, what the something could the government do that Victor Perton himself can't do globally? Going right back to the 90s, Con, yeah, you know, yeah, yeah. World Bank and Rwanda. And so I thought, you're right. So that night we registered all the URLs for the Centre for Optimism. We leased premises in Middle Park with just a conference table, you know, with getting people together. And, of course, what happened 3 months later, Con? COVID.
Our friend COVID, yeah.
We couldn't have it. So we moved online. And those who go to the website, if you just Google the Center for Optimism, you will find the largest website on optimism. And we helped lift people through COVID. You know, we did events for the Congo. We did a series called Optimism of the Heart. And so our purpose, our mission is to help lift optimism one at a time. if we can lift it in a community, and I've done whole communities, we've done whole organizations, but the notion is optimism is healthy for you. So Harvard University, the American military, and Boston University published research in 2018 that said for healthy longevity, in the case of you and me as blokes living to 85 in good physical and mental health, for women 90 in physical and mental good physical and mental health, it's not genetics or geography. It's not wealth or income. The key trait that predicts healthy longevity is optimism. And there have been lots of studies since then. The key protective trait against heart disease, the key protective trait against cancer, the key protective trait against dementia is optimism. And in the case of the first two, which is why the cardiologists and the like what I do, is it's the key predictor of recovery. So if you're a heart surgeon or a cardiologist and you want the patient you've operated on or you're treating to get better, then you want to be infectiously optimistic. You want your staff to be infectiously optimistic, and you want to teach that person to be infectiously optimistic. So we teach habits of optimism, smile and greet everyone like the Dalai Lama does, laugh more, change your greeting, use gratitude journaling. We've got 20 online. If people Google the habits of an optimist, they'll find us. But and in fact, during lockdown, we even created an animated course, which included the Australian Children's Choir and all sorts of celebrities telling people how to be more optimistic. So that's what we do. And we've got 8,000 subscribers and supporters, as I said, as you said, in 82 countries. You know, some more active than others, but as in life. And a lot of people follow us on social media. You know, I keep meeting people who say, you lift me every day with that little post on LinkedIn or Twitter or the like. And it's as you say, if you can make a difference to one person's morning, you've done a good thing. So it's a lot of fun. All of you listeners, you are welcome. Just go onto the website, Center for Optimism. You can spell it the American or the Australian way. It doesn't matter. You'll find us. And just sign up to our blog. You'll get updates every couple of weeks, or if I'm too busy, maybe every 3 weeks. But it will keep you in touch and connect. And really, but also that notion of we've got a lovely little 5-minute survey, what makes you optimistic? And it just prompts people to think. And then I've got another exercise. I was lucky enough 2 months ago, a real estate conference in Brisbane had me up in Brisbane, and they said, could you do that superpower of optimism thing you do? So if people, again, want to Google your superpower of optimism, there's just this lovely exercise where you pick an optimism and you write or think about how it fits into your life. And then another one we do, Con, is my best possible self. So every change of season, we do this worldwide online gathering where people could do this after they listen to this broadcast, Con. The trick is spend 5 minutes imagining yourself. So close your eyes, Con, think of yourself looking in the mirror. And, you'll probably be a little bit grayer, a little bit thinner. Both of us will be fitter. Imagine your family's good. Imagine society's good. You're doing the work or the hobbies you like. And then you spend 5 minutes writing about a day in your life in 5 years' time. And you might be on holidays in Venice, or, you might be at work in some new job. And it's immensely powerful. The Vienna Medical School says it's one of the best ways to enhance optimism. And in their case, it was sleeping better was what they were aiming to teach. But my best self is a beautiful exercise. I recently did it in Bendigo, the Chamber of Commerce, with 50 people. And you know what? They all shared it. 49 out of the 50 wanted to share what they'd be doing in 5 years' time. And it wasn't all about work. It was a lot about family and grandchildren and, their dream holiday. And, of course, if you talk about your dream holiday with other people, you're more likely to make it come true.
Indeed, indeed. Also, listening to when I spoke to Cindy, she mentioned that ultimately looking for joy in your life ultimately is a choice. And Viktor Frankl, who, for the listeners that don't know him, Google him, was an...
Make sure that the Viktor's with a K and the Frankl doesn't have an E.
Austrian psychiatrist who was in concentration camp during World War II. Both his parents and wife were murdered by the Nazis, and he experienced, obviously, the brutality of the Nazi regime and the awful conditions. And one of the things that he wrote, "Everything can be taken from man but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way." So a man who was in the most challenging of conditions, brutalized daily, murdered relatives, still believed that he had control of his perspective. And so optimism ultimately is a choice. Yes.
And it's an interesting coincidence because the Center for Optimism and I were chosen by a Finnish organization called the Art and Science of Joy to be their first superpower of joy. So they are celebrating a year of joy. And they thought optimism is the fundamental. And so I've written about that. Optimists experience more joy because you're looking for the positive. So, you know, I walk down the street and there's this raucous noise of a parrot. And I look up and there's an orange or yellow-breasted parrot, you know, in the gum tree outside my house. You know, I notice the daffodils, the jonquils, the roses. I notice someone smile when they're serving me in a shop. I go to a cafe called Hurricane Handsome, which obviously wasn't named after me, Colin. But I'm treated like royalty because, you know, the waitresses, and they're mainly waitresses, I always say, what's been the best thing in your day or week? And they love sharing that. But at the end of, you know, breakfast or my coffee there, I pop by the kitchen and I thank the chef. You know, that was beautiful chili eggs or beautiful, given that I live in Port Melbourne, avocado on toast. And then I pop by the barista, you know, thank you for that coffee. The pattern today was so beautiful. And so the optimist, because you're looking for the positive in most experiences, experiences more joy. And yeah, when I reread my book the other day, the new edition of my book has a chapter on joy because I actually didn't have it in the first edition. But the word joy appears 20 times in the book in other circumstances. So Cindy and you nail it, because happiness is too hard, right? Happiness is 100 things. So, you know, you say to someone, are you happy? Well, look, they may have just had a rotten car drive home. You know, they're stuck on the Westgate Freeway for an hour and a half because of the big build, or, you know, their teenage son or daughter's been grumpy or whatever. So there's lots of reasons to be unhappy at a particular time. Very difficult to be happy all the time. But to experience moments of joy and to revel in them and to talk about them. And, you know, I had lots and lots of adventures. And I think my mum taught me storytelling with amusement. You know, you talk about, you know, that dinner in Kazakhstan where they asked you to drink fermented mare's milk and, you know, all of those, or spiders in Cambodia, or, you know, you all of those, because teenagers these days often say to you, what was the worst air flight you had? And I never think of the worst air flight. I always think of the funniest air flight. Now, you know, in retrospect, it may have been the worst air flight, you know, the one from Beijing to Ho Ho Hot. And, you know, there was a shocking storm. We got hit by lightning. There were pigs and, you know, chickens in cages on the plane. But of course, you know, 30 years later, it's one of the funniest stories you can tell. So it turns into a moment of joy. And I was listening again to this wonderful neuroscientist the other day who says, you make your own memories. So very few of us have an accurate memory. Most of our memories are recast in the stories we tell about it. So if we tell positive stories rather than negative stories, our memories adapt to the story we tell.
Very, very interesting. Very interesting. Victor, I am sure you're confronted with many questions along these lines. We live in a time where interest rates, cost of living pressures, Ukraine-Russian conflict, Pacific tensions with China and Taiwan, our good buddy in North Korea, nuclear devices. It doesn't matter what you turn the channel on, it's the news and you're just bombarded with it. So I have two questions. So firstly, what do you see as the media's responsibility in terms of delivering news? Because you made a comment much earlier in regards to it's now 24/7, we're bombarded. But also, second to that, is in the face of that gloom and doom, where do we find optimism and how?
Let's answer the second question first. It's doing what you do. Right? It's sharing the good news. So everyone listening to this, every day in every conversation, share something good. If you're on social media, if you're on LinkedIn or Twitter or Facebook or Instagram or Snapchat, you know, at your workplace, there'll be something interesting happening. There'll be some success. Or if you're a member of Dementia Australia, or you're a member of the Red Cross or St. John Ambulance, there'll be something good happening. And so 98% of news is good news. So if we come back to the broadcast news, Con, they're completely irresponsible. If you watch Channel 2 today on the news channel, there will be more health warnings than in a carton of cigarettes. Just watch it for an hour and think, multiply that by 24, a carton of cigarettes looks safe compared to watching the news. And so Steven Pinker, the head of psychology at Harvard, wrote a very good book called The Enlightenment. And in that book, they mapped the change in the news from the 1970s to today. And in the 1970s, the news was roughly 50-50 good, bad. You know, there's been an awful car crash. We had a camera crew there. But, you know, the Red Cross have launched a new campaign for blood. And here's the people they save through blood transfusions and the like. And today the news is nearly between 95 and 98% bad. So they buy the bad news cheap. If you've... You know, when we're recording this, you know, there's been that shooting in France. God, it's like it's been in the streets of Melbourne. You know, the first 5 minutes of the news is we're watching buildings burning in Paris. And, you know, isn't this shocking? So the news, I think, has a significant effect two ways. One is it changes our perception of the world. So instead of the world we know and live, which is essentially good most of the time, the news makes us think that the world's awful. And there's a beautiful book. If anyone wants to read a really good book on this, it's by a Swedish doctor who died just before he finished the book, Hans Rosling, R-O-S-L-I-N-G. And it's called Factfulness. And so most people have got the wrong impression of the world by watching the news. The world is more peaceful today than it was 100 years ago. Your chances of dying in an accident are less than they were 100 years ago. Your chances of being murdered or assaulted are less than 100 years ago. The average lifespan of an Aussie 100 years ago, an Aussie male, Con, you know, you and I would both be dead. Oh. You know, it was 50, right? Today, you know, you and I can expect to live to 85 in good physical and mental health and beyond. No one will be surprised if we live to 100. You know, the medicines that are available to us, the new services that are available to us, the transportation that's available to us, the clean water, right? You have to be a billionaire to have these sorts of things in 1900, right? And so I think our advice is you've got to turn off the news, right? You want to sound informed, right? You don't want to sound stupid. So 15 minutes of the news in the morning, 15 minutes in the evening should be the max, right? Read other stuff, read industry newsletters, read magazines. You know, dare I say it, you know, sometimes the teenagers have got it right. You know, watching TikTok short videos and the like. You know, it drives me mad with my teenage daughter and I say, oh, you know, can't you read books more? And then I realize I'm the dinosaur. So I think the news is actually, and someone actually, I listened to a thing the other day. Someone actually pointed out the fact that in the 1950s, when all these companies got their broadcasting licenses, the news was an obligation, right? They thought they'd make their money from ads in Here Comes Lucy and Bob Dyer's Pick a Box and the like. They didn't think of the news as a money spinner. Today, the news is a money spinner. You know, you look at 60 Minutes and you will be shocked. You will be horrified. But of course, every 6 minutes or less, there's 4 minutes of advertisements. Exactly. It's a bit like those wonderful shows on, you know, police drug testing.
And the RBT.
Testing drivers. And, you know, they put the sleeve into the person's mouth and they're breathing. And then all of a sudden you go to an ad break. You never know. You've got to wait another 5 or 6 minutes to find out what they blew or did they have methamphetamine on their tongue. So, no, you nail it. And that's why what you do, Con, is so important. And to share the bits and pieces of this. And so each of your listeners, if you could have the resolution once a week on LinkedIn, once a week on Facebook, or once a week on Twitter, share a good story. If you see a good story, comment on it and praise the person. So with journalists, Con, if I see them use the word optimism in their article and I've got their email, I will send them a letter of thanks and praise. Or on TV yesterday, the Ukrainian ambassador was on. And I just sent an email to say you were terrific on television yesterday. And he wrote me back this morning. You know, thank you, and actually offered to do something for me for our Nelson Mandela Youth Leadership Summit. Awesome. But just that little notion of thanks when you see some good news on television or radio in a newspaper, and you can make a huge difference as a citizen, because hardly anyone writes something nice. Most people are complainers when they write to the ABC or Channel 9 or the Herald Sun. But your superpower is optimism. Your superpower is praise. Your superpower is thanks. Your superpower is meeting difficulty with a smile.
Mm. Thank you for those wonderful words, Victor. And as we...
Well, you nailed it. I mean, that's what you are doing is so important.
It's
so important. If you could do this twice a week, I reckon we'd all be better off.
I'd love to do one every day, but that won't happen just at the minute. Victor, I want to take us out by
let's keep going.
Mentioning a few things for our audience. In a time where human condition and the propensity to focus on the negative, in other words, you know, what can go wrong. I'm reminded of a wonderful quote by Dr. Wayne Dwyer: change the way you look at things and the things you look at change. On that note, ladies and gentlemen, it's been my absolute pleasure to have Victor Perton as my guest today, the Chief Optimistic Officer from the Department of Optimism.
That's a tongue twister, Colin.
That's a tongue twister in itself, Victor. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today.
And shall we end up with some laughter?
Just before we do, let me sign off. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Con. I am the conversationalist. And until next time, join us for a laugh now. 1, 2, 3. Victor. And we're done, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of A Cuppa with a Conversationalist. To join in next time, follow or subscribe. And for more information about my coaching and workshops, visit my website at www.conkoutsikas.com.